to be a very controversial and difficult subject. And part of the reason that it's controversial and difficult is because people really haven't defined what they're talking about. And some of what we'd like to do today is to try to get across to you just as simply as possible how you can understand a little bit more about why all this controversy is raging. You know, I've got up here all sorts of things that have come out. These are position papers from the geologists, from the National Academy of Sciences, a compendium of information on the theory of evolution and the evolution of creation controversy has come out from the National Institute of Biology teachers. You've got books coming out faster than I can read them, all over the place, on this problem that many people believe is a kind of a sickness in our society of wanting to teach creationism in the schools. And that's what this particular book is all about, Abusing Science, the Case Against Creationism. And I just suggest to you, right off the bat, that if you'll look at the titles, both the ones that are being written by those who are evolutionary in their point of view, and those who have traditionally been arguing the case for creationism, people out of the Creation Research Society, people like Henry Morris and Duane Gish, that on both sides of this issue, they are not very good about defining terms. And they use it as though you're talking about creation versus evolution, or science versus God, or Darwin versus Jesus, and I don't believe that that's the issue at all. What we want to cover this morning particularly, so that you understand, is that there's more than one theory of evolution. There is one theory of evolution which is in direct contradiction to the scriptures. What we call the general theory of evolution. It's the kind of amoeba to man, and I'll get to that in a second. There is a second one that we would just term the special theory of evolution, which has to do with things changing genetically. Okay, and most of us are familiar with this in terms of the breeding of dogs, the breeding of cattle, the breeding of horses, etc., etc. And those kinds of changes are not out of harmony with the scriptures, and they never have been. Now, if you just put a title up that says, the theory of evolution is taught as a fact in the school, which theory are you talking about? If you've got one theory that you agree with and one that you don't, one that can be supported by science and one that is purely philosophical, and somebody just says, well, I don't believe in the theory of evolution, aren't you confusing the issue? Don't you have to separate out, if there's really two theories of evolution, wouldn't you have to separate out between the two? And that's the one thing that I do not see being done. I've talked to a lot of people about this from both sides of the issue, and I have developed a different approach to this subject. You know, you can deal with somebody who disagrees with you in a number of ways. One of the most unfair is to have a rather sympathetic audience to talk to and take all of their weak points and tear them up on that and present your strong points. Okay, and that's the way a lot of these presentations get made on both sides of this particular issue. And I don't think that's fair. What I think a person ought to be able to do is to deal with both positions in their strongest form. And so I developed a different approach. Now, I grew up a strict evolutionist. You need to understand that. You know, I didn't grow up believing the Bible. I wouldn't say that I was an atheist. I was certainly an agnostic. And I was 21 years old and already getting ready to get into my master's program at the University of Louisville in biology at the time I became a Christian, and this issue was forced upon me against my will, because I really didn't care to deal with it at the time. But the way it was forced upon me was I was told that if I ever held the position that God created in the way the Bible talks about creation, a six-day creation, that I simply could not get a master's from that program. I mean, I was told that point blank by the man who taught, was responsible for teaching all of the evolution courses. Well, that, you know, that's a bit of a challenge, and it puts you kind of on the defensive. And while I was at the University of Louisville, I developed this particular approach, which I'll just tell you is different from anything I think that is being used today. I have taught it this way at the University of Florida, you know, what a lot of people would call a two-model presentation without any ill effect. You know, they knew I was teaching it that way. And it is designed to let people look at the evidence and see two particular interpretations of that evidence and then make up their own minds as to which one they think is most reasonable. All right, and I have a lot of trouble with people who get up and talk about evolutionists who are unfair and they don't want to know the truth and all that kind of stuff, because I was an evolutionist and I wasn't that way. And if somebody had approached me that way, I'd have just turned off to everything that they were saying, because I would have known in my heart that they were being unfair to me, because that isn't the way I felt about it. I just found it difficult. I found it to be a massive subject area that was exceptionally difficult to deal with, and I wasn't sure how to do it. This is just an example of what I'm talking about. You put up quotes like this, okay? Here's just different. That's about the best we can do. Evolution is unproved and unprovable. Which evolution are you talking about? Okay? We believe it because the only alternative is special creation, and that's unthinkable. That does not help people to understand this issue. Because it does not distinguish between these two different theories. And I'm just, you know, we have people all over the country who would like to see both taught and don't know how to define it. They don't know that there's more than one theory of special creation and there's more than one theory of evolution. You know, here you've got only 5% of this survey thought that evolution should be taught alone. But there's no distinction made for them as to whether they mean by that the special or the general theory of evolution. Is evolution taught as a fact? Okay? Somebody like Carl Sagan will come out that evolution is not a theory, but it's a fact. The second one, it's difficult for any qualified biology teacher to present it as anything less than an established fact. Well, which theory of evolution are you talking about? All right, and if you don't get anything else out of this talk while I'm up here, if you will try to understand the difference between the two theories, I think you'll understand why this controversy has raged for over 100 years with experts holding both positions. You know, somebody can come along and say, well, evolution is as firmly established as the fact that the Earth is round, and that's an easy statement to make, and then I can list off for you 100 experts in the field of biology or chemistry or physics who do not feel that way. But what I'm saying is that people on both sides are not making a very important distinction. And that has to do with these two different theories. So, is it just a theory? A title like that doesn't help. Again, there's not a distinction. Now, this is what I was given. This is what was said about people who wouldn't teach the theory of evolution in the classroom. Okay? That a person lacked the ability of comprehension. They didn't belong in the classroom. I don't know why that's so hazy. Everything's set up right here. Does not belong in the classroom, is deceiving himself and others, denies the evidence, is not honest, gives support to bigotry, and is prejudiced and ignorant. And after you said all of that, what have you contributed to the discussion of this? Absolutely nothing. And I could go right down the list and quote a bunch of preachers who said the same thing about evolution. And that doesn't contribute anything to the discussion either. There is getting to be a very radical approach to this, though, by those who are already in university positions particularly. people like Carl Sagan, Isaac Asimov, and the writer.
That turned the microphone off.
They'll be able
to. I wanted to get that light off.
Turn it off in just a second. Can you hear me in the back without any difficulty? I mean, I've been accused of being a loudmouth. And I think I can carry it. It'll make it a lot easier for people to see. I'm uncomfortable with this. It's like a hearing aid. I'm not that age yet. I could give you all sorts of quotes. I could give you all sorts of surveys. But I want you to look at this, okay? No advocate of such propaganda should be trusted to teach science classes or administer science programs anywhere or under any circumstances. Moreover, if any are now doing so, they should be dismissed. Now, that's a fairly strong statement. Now, what that says is that when I taught at the University of Florida and I presented it this way, that I should not have been viewed as a scientist, and no young person should have been trusted to my care as a teacher, because I had already proven myself to be closed-minded and ignorant, and I really should have been kicked out of the university. And somebody says, I didn't know they were feeling that strong about it. Well, they are feeling that strong about it. And I'd suggest to you that during the next 10 years, it isn't going to get any easier. It's going to get worse. To me, the solution has to do, here's a quote that was interesting, the American Civil Liberties Union, who took the position of the evolutionists in the Arkansas case, simply said that they were hoping that the judge would be able to state that there is absolutely no scientific evidence for creationism. That's what they wanted out of the whole thing. It isn't a question of evidence. We're not talking about facts, and it's just important that I get right into this distinction, so let me shuffle down through my overheads here. When I was in school, these were the evidences that were given to me for evolutionary theory, okay? From the idea of comparing organisms, you compare their anatomy and their physiology and their chemistry and all of that. The idea of vestigial organs, organs that supposedly were left over in our bodies from a common ancestor and used to have a purpose, but they don't anymore. The field of genetics, which is intended to be the statement of the mechanism by which evolutionary change takes place. Fossil men, you know, your so-called missing link discussion. Fossils in general. Paleontology is the whole fossil record in general, all right? And then the age of the Earth, and these are probably the six common areas where things are talked about. And what my professor did, and I was taking advanced evolutionary theory at the time with master's and PhD candidates. Yeah, he just came in and he laid that out and he said, David, here's why I believe in evolution on the basis of scientific evidence. Where is your evidence? Well, being bright, I couldn't answer the question. I had no idea what to say to that. And it took a while before it dawned on me that that's my evidence. I mean, that evidence is my evidence, too. I have a right to look at it and see if I can interpret it from another point of view. And if I can, you know, and I haven't violated any of the scientific evidence, then essentially you have two alternative explanations of the same evidence. Okay? Now let me just, you know, finally, after 15 years, I went on and made up this. That's the evidence for creation. It's the exact same evidence. All right, now I really need to make this distinction. Let's talk for a second about what a scientific proof is. In order to prove something scientifically, you must be able to take your point of view and explain all of the evidence. And I suggest that you can explain basically all of the scientific evidence on the basis of evolutionary biology. But you also must be able to disprove and set aside any alternative explanation. You must be able to eliminate it and show that it is not a viable option in explaining that evidence. And so all I tried to do as a graduate student was to see if I could take that same evidence and interpret it from the standpoint of a six-day creation and a Genesis flood. Okay, now you don't have to go to the Bible to do that. There's abundant evidence in literature that people have believed this in many different societies far outside what we would call the Judeo-Christian tradition. All right, there are flood legends from all around the world. So there's some scholarly reasons for going and interpreting and seeing if maybe this geologic evidence, for instance, could be interpreted and explained on the basis of a worldwide flood. There's a legitimate reason for going that direction that has nothing to do with the Bible. And sometimes people say, the only reason, David, that you would ever question this is because you've already accepted the Bible. And all I can say to that is hogwash, because that's not the reason. There's a lot of different historic reasons why people might look for explanations that involve a supernatural creator and a worldwide flood that don't come out of the Bible as literature, but come from all around the world in literature from all around the world. You know, sociologists, I could just see a sociology professor setting up a program for his graduate student. You know, why would it be that every place you go in the world that there's some kind of creation account and some kind of flood legend? Okay? My point is that we're only talking about an interpretation of evidence. You have a pile of evidence up here. And people approach that evidence from some kind of philosophical framework. Now, if I take those numbers and I can lay them out horizontally, or I can lay them out vertically, all right? But that choice is mine, all right? Depending on my particular point of view or my framework. Now, there's only a couple of different views about origin. One says it all came into existence naturally, and one says that it had the help of some supernatural agent, something outside of nature. That's the only two views that I know of. All right? So a person ought to be willing to explain what their philosophic presuppositions are when they go to the evidence. And what I find is that in most textbooks, one particular philosophic point of view is given and tied to the evidence as if it was evidence itself. And that is the evolutionary explanation, the naturalistic explanation of how things came into existence. And it's really this discussion of origins. That's really the thing that is being debated now. It's not Darwin. It's not natural selection. It's not genetics. You know, most creationists will admit up front that they have no problems with that. You know, it is the question of ultimate origins. Where did the universe come from? How did life begin? And where did man come from? And is man unique? And there's only two views that I know of. And as far as I can tell, it's purely a matter of interpreting the evidence and seeing whether it'll fit your presupposition. And I'll just tell you up front again that neither group can explain all of the evidence. And that's where most of these discussions are going on now. The evolutionist is pointing to the creationist's weak point where he can't explain the evidence. The creationist is pointing to the evolutionist's weak points where he cannot explain evidence. And it's kind of a stalemated thing that doesn't help anybody. It doesn't help anybody. Now, I believe it's all a matter of faith on origin. Was there any, I have asked this every place I've ever gone, is there anybody here who was there to observe it? Just in case I have missed someone. I mean, I wasn't, no matter how old you think I am, I was not there to observe it, and either theory postulates conditions that do not exist today, or you cannot just go out and readily observe today in nature, don't they? It's either this primeval ocean with an atmosphere that is not like today that is postulated, and that's where life sprang forth spontaneously, or else it was a creation by something outside of the natural system which none of us were there to witness. Now, I don't care which way you go on that, whichever one you believe is a matter of faith. You did not observe it, and you cannot test it, and the conditions don't exist today. That's outside science. Now, why is it that it's been such a big discussion? I thought this was interesting in the Woodlouse connection. It says here, start with Sagan right here. Sagan is operating in the same vein when he says that oak trees are our relatives. Now, that's the general theory of evolution. Okay, and I still haven't defined that for you, and I've got to. Increasingly, pop evolutionists write as if human evolution from the animal kingdom is proven, and as if evolution is the sole explanation of all life. And it's true. That's just how it's written in the textbooks. Let's face it. Once one's mind is tilting in this direction, it easily slides off into peculiar and narrow speculations on man's place in the meaning of nature. Willy-nilly, we have hundreds of biology and anthropology texts whose authors have succumbed to the cosmological imperative, offering not just the facts of biology, but also their own philosophical beliefs. Now, I think that's true. And that's why a lot of people are upset about this. If it's all right for one group of people to put their philosophy in the textbook along with the facts, why can't you take this other philosophy, the supernatural point of view, and put it in the textbooks along with, you know, as an explanation of the facts? If one person can push their philosophy that way, why can't the other people? It is a discussion over origin. That is the true argument. It is not over the fact. It is over the philosophical interpretation of the fact. And what you get down to is something just like you have in a courtroom. You got somebody over here who is a defense attorney defending a client. You've got a prosecution attorney who is trying to prosecute that client. And they've got a pile of evidence up there on that front table. And the prosecuting attorney goes down through that evidence, and he does what? He or she explains the evidence to try to make it fit their point of view that this person committed the crime. That's what they do. All they're hired to do is to explain that evidence as best they can to show that this person committed the crime. Now, when they get done, the trial's not over, because this other person is given the opportunity, the defense attorney, to take the same evidence and explain it from the point of view that their client is not guilty. Now, what happens if they're both able to explain all of the evidence from their point of view? Get a hung jury. Why? Because neither one of them can explain away the other guy's position. And that's where I think we are in this other discussion today. Really, I can't explain away all of the evolutionary explanation. I can't disprove it scientifically because I can't do the experiment. I can't go back and do the creation again if God's not doing that regularly. Neither can an evolutionist. I can't, when I teach evolution, tell a student that we can go back into the laboratory and do an experiment to test that, because there is no such thing. It doesn't exist. And when you get down to origin, it just ends up being a matter of faith. It's a reason faith, and I make no apology for believing on faith, but I do get tired of people telling me that they believe the general theory of evolution on the basis of science, and I believe on the basis of faith. No, that's not true. Now, again, I'm still to the point where I haven't described this. I'd like to look at this one quote first. Herman J. Mueller takes this position. It's the second quote. He says, "There are no hypotheses alternative to the principle of evolution with its tree of life, which most of us understand." That's the general theory of evolution he's talking about. But wouldn't it have been nice if he could put the word general in there? To let us know that he's not talking about the special theory of evolution. "The general theory of evolution with its tree of life that any competent biologist of today takes seriously." Now, I'm either not competent or I'm not serious. Now, that's what you got to know about him. If he's right, then I'm either not competent in the field of biology or I'm not serious today. And I feel like I'm both. "Moreover, the principle is so important for an understanding of the world that we live in and of ourselves that the public in general, including students taking biology in high school, should be made aware of it and of the fact that it is firmly established, even as the rotundity of the earth is firmly established." Now, that's a pretty heavy statement. What he's talking about is this. And right here, I have an example of the two theories of evolution. He's talking about this tree of life, the idea that all of these variations that we see can ultimately be shown to have funneled back to some original common ancestor, which ultimately came from a non-living source. Okay, you've got all these dog varieties, cat varieties, horse varieties, cattle varieties, sheep varieties, and they all ultimately go back to some non-living source that spontaneously came into existence, brought spontaneously into existence some living thing, some small living thing that gave rise to all of this. Well, that's the general theory of evolution, all right. But nobody argues about this. Any of y'all ever been to where they breed cattle or horses or anything? I mean, you've seen that stuff done, haven't you? We call it artificial selection. Darwin called it natural selection. I don't have any problem with that. But that's not the thing that we're arguing about. The Bible doesn't disagree with that. Go back to Genesis 31 sometime and look at Jacob as he's trying to get away from Laban, and you'll find him breeding cattle, trying to select for the speckled and the spotted. What's that if it's not artificial selection? That's in the same book, by the way, that talks about the creation account and the flood. And he had some understanding of modern-day breeding techniques because he realized the miracle that God had done, that he should have been getting just a few of those, and that's all he was getting. He knew that was outside of the natural. That wasn't the way he had seen it before. Normally, he would have expected just a few of those, and that's all he was getting. He knew it was a miracle. Well, that man had some modern genetics in his mind. He understood that breeding. They understood about breeding for the strong. They understood about keeping the best ears of corn that you had and using them as seed for the next year. That's modern genetics. They may not have understood the mechanism, but they understood the principle, and they used it, and that's back in the Genesis account. These people weren't ignorant. Now, there is a biologist who has made the distinction. A lot of times people say that creationists are the ones who came up with the distinction. It's not true. The distinction I can point out in a number of textbooks by very prominent biologists, but the most clear statement of it is by G.A. Kirkuk in his book, Implications of Evolution, which is a part of an international series of monographs on pure and applied biology. That's his credentials. He was the general editor of the zoology division. He lived in England, and he made this distinction. "There is a theory which states that many animals can be observed over the course of time to undergo changes so that new species are formed." That's one theory, the idea that over the course of time, some new species may be formed. "This can be called the special theory of evolution, and can be demonstrated in certain cases by experiment, and I believe that. And I don't have time to give you all the examples, but that's not out of harmony with the Scripture. The idea of change within limits is not out of the, it's not out of harmony with what the Scripture says. But look at the other theory. On the other hand, there's a theory that all the living forms in the world have arisen from a single source, which itself came from a non-living or inorganic form. This theory can be called the general theory of evolution, and the evidence that supports it is not sufficiently strong to allow us to consider it as anything more than a working hypothesis. It is not clear whether the changes that bring about the first changes, the special theory changes, speciation, are of the same nature as those that would have brought about the development of new phyla, larger groups of animals, moving, say, from reptiles to mammals. Okay? The answer will be found by future experimental work and not by dogmatic assertions that the general theory of evolution must be correct because there is nothing else that will satisfactorily take its place. Now, this is a biologist who's an evolutionist. This is not a creationist statement. And so if you ever hear somebody say, oh, that's just that distinction between general and special, micro and macro evolution, that's the creationist who brought that up. No, it isn't. It was a scientific statement by G.A. Turcutt, and he's not the only one. It's been around for a long time. Darwin noticed it, and he was much more honest about that distinction than most people give him credit for. Now, this is the part of the statement that has to do with the special theory. Let me show you some examples. Y'all ever seen the evolution of the horse in any of these textbooks? What they did is they took the skeletons of what they believed to be horses, and they simply aligned them by size. And they gave us what they call a phylogeny of the horse, going from a small creature, not much larger than a good-sized jackrabbit, up to our modern-day horses. I have no problem with this, because I can go out on a farm out here and find people who have horses that are this tall, and you've got your Clydesdale, and you've got everything else in between. And if I took their skeletons and laid them out in order, I could probably show you that, couldn't I? The way I order those skeletons has to do with my presuppositions about how things came into existence. And that's how this chart came into existence. Now, let's just say that there are new species of horses that have been produced. All right, let's just say that's happened. Do we have any mechanisms that show change without any limitations at all? Do we have a genetic mechanism to show change without any limitations? No, we don't. And I say that as a scientist, not as a preacher. Now, I can show you genetic mechanisms that show change within limits. These breeders will tell you they can get the horse so small and no smaller. Or they can get it so large and no larger. Or they can make the front of it bigger and no bigger. We can go to the people who experiment with things like sugar beets. Now, why do you want to experiment with a sugar beet? I bet not a one of you is going to do that this afternoon. And probably are not interested in ever doing that. But we get sugar from sugar beets. So if the sugar content of the average old sugar beet, 7%, wouldn't it be nice to be able to increase that so that when you harvested your crop, that the average amount was 14% or 20% or 100%? Because you're after the sugar. The rest of it's just garbage to you. You know, all you want is the sugar. So what have they done? They've done breeding experiments. And they take the beets every year that have the highest sugar content, and they use them to grow the beets for the next year. Now, is there anybody that doesn't understand that? You know, you want bigger dogs, so every year you take the biggest dogs out of the litter and you just let them breed. Then you take the biggest dogs out of that litter and you let them breed, and you start increasing the size of each thing. Now, we all understand that. That's not difficult. But it's also not what the Bible is in contradiction with either. There are limits to the amount of change that you can get. With sugar beets, they started in 1820. Ancient history. Back in 1820. They went till the turn of the century, and they had increased the sugar content from 7% to 14%. They continued that same process for another 40 years and could never increase the sugar content past that. There are limits to the amount of change and variation that you can get genetically. Well, now the Bible says that. God created everything to reproduce after its own kind. The kind isn't the species. Okay. It is in some cases, but it's not in all cases. It appears to be in man's case, but not in cattle. In Leviticus, it talks about cattle being a kind, and there's four genera of cattle and a bunch of species. So it can't always mean the species. We use the word mankind straight out of the scripture because we believe that man is a kind and man is also a species, biologically viewed as a species. Can't interbreed with any other organism and produce fertile offspring. But it's not always the species. Now that was a problem the creationists had about 100 years ago because they were saying that the Bible said that and the Bible didn't say that. Well, see, they've done us a lot of damage, is what they've done. What about some other examples? Well, obviously, I've talked about all the different ways you can breed dogs, all the different ways that you can breed cattle, all the different ways that finches can change in nature, the different ways that peppered moths can change under different environmental conditions. And I think every one of these examples is an example of the same thing. Change within the limits of the genetics that are already there in the population of that species. But that isn't a mechanism that will explain the general theory of evolution. You'd have to have a mechanism that clearly demonstrated you could continue to get change with no limits to be able to cross these larger boundaries. Now, that's the general theory. And all that is a statement of what I read to you earlier. And this is the way it is presented in the textbook. Right there. Now, you remember the thing I showed you with the horse? Let me show you where that is on the chart. It's right here. That line right there. All that stuff on that other chart fits into that one line. Do you understand what I'm saying? What's at the bottom of this line here as it leads down towards the reptile? There's a bunch of dots there, aren't there? Do you know what those dots represent? Now think on this. I have a quiz I'm going to pass out at the end of this. Those dots say there's no fossils. In order to establish a mechanism for the general theory of evolution, you're either going to have to find fossils that go from that itty-bitty jackrabbit-sized horse down to the reptiles in a clear sequence, which we do not have and have never had, and I don't believe ever will have. There are no transitional fossils like that. Or you're going to have to do an experiment where you breed horses backwards until you get a reptile, and they ought to be able to do that. And you should be able to do breeding experiments like that, right? Just take what you have and start breeding backwards. The Russians have done it, by the way. Where did I put that thing? I'll get to it now. I'll show you what they've done with an extinct muck ox. They bred backwards until they reproduced the thing, something that had been extinct for about 300 years. But the general theory of evolution, and the way, look at all the dotted lines on here. You know, you got to fill in those dotted lines, either with fossils or with experimental evidence that it can happen. And that's never been done. In fact, without going into all the quotes that I have on it, all of the biologists who are even evolutionists are pretty much shifting their emphasis now and saying, we'll never fill in the gaps. So it must have happened some other way. And they're beginning to throw away the old traditional mechanism that I've just been talking about. But they don't have anything to offer scientifically in replacement of it. Just an idea. They don't have any scientific evidence to back it up. Massive changes and then relatively long periods of stability. And then another massive change. But they don't offer any scientific evidence to back that up except the fossil record itself. And you need to understand where all of that came from, and I'll deal with that. So what I've got is this. Here are the two ideas. Within the gene pool of doggies, okay, you can change dogs and make them bigger or smaller or fatter or taller and speckled or spotted or solid colored or with a longer nose. And when you get done with all that, you've got doggies. Just like you can show, if let's just say that they're right about that fossil stuff on the horse. You got little horses that don't have as many toes, and you got, have more toes, and you got big horses that don't have as many, and they got bigger and fatter, and changed their shape and maybe their colors, but you started out with horses and you ended up with horses. And all the classic examples that are supposed to support the theory of evolution, the general theory of evolution, really show change within limits. That's all they show. And as yet, it has never been demonstrated that you can move from one major group to the other, which is what's required over here, starting out with some kind of amoeboid or single-celled type living thing that eventually gave rise to everything that has ever lived or that lives now. Plants and animals, you know, I'm third cousin to a cockroach and first cousin of a tree. That kind of thing. Be respectful of your relatives. When you pull that fly swat out, Uncle Harry! Not going to use it. Not going to use my neck. Let me give you an example of how I've done this. Before we take a break, okay, and if you've got to get up and go out, crawl under the pews, or that not. Comparative anatomy and physiology. The idea is that you put animals or plants or what have you up against each other. Almost all of my scientific quotations come from zoology as opposed to botany. Now, I'm a botanist. That's the simple term. I am a classical taxonomist. I did a taxonomic, I got to show off because I did take a long time. I did a taxonomic revision of some old world mosses. Isn't that exciting? I knew it. If you really have to read this, when we get done, it'll be up here. I'm a classical taxonomist. I took morphologically or anatomically, I took a bunch of old world mosses that I have never seen grow in the wild, and I revised two genera. And I took 51 species names, and I reduced them to two genera, one which had two species and one that had four. And are they really species? Because I've never done any kind of developmental experiments. I've never grown them in a lab. Yeah, they're accepted as species because that's the only way a botanist can do it. Okay, that's been primarily botany. You won't find botanists being the main ones who are arguing evolutionary theory. It's almost always zoologists. And there's a reason for that. Most of my quotes come from that. Here's a statement that all animals are alike in being composed of protoplasm organized as cells. Oh. Okay, let's forget the fact that a lizard's forearm looks like yours. Okay, let's just, I'll show you that. You see this? Here you are, and here's the lizard. And except for size, there's not much difference in the bone. Now that's evidence. You understand, that's evidence. I'm not denying the similarity. The question is how you explain it. Okay? Evolutionarily, they explain it by the closer the similarity, the closer the evolutionary relationship. In other words, lizards and us are kind of closer in our relationship evolutionarily because of these similarities than, say, I would be to a jellyfish, okay, which is a non-vertebrate. Makes sense, right? That's one explanation of the evidence. I've had some people who try to deny the similarity. How do you deny that? You know what that is standing up there? Now, don't say the man. I get to call the man. You tell me what the other thing is. It's a horse. You see any similarity between the skeletons? Well, why would we want to go around saying there's no similarity in organisms? That's silly. But that's evidence. Now, how you explain that evidence is something entirely different. All right, they would like to explain all of that as being part of an ancestral pattern. Okay, and I'm going to read the quote as it is found in this one book. The conclusion is inescapable that the limb bones of man, the bat, and the whale are modifications of a common ancestral pattern. The fact admits of no other logical explanation. Now that's the part I have trouble with. Okay, because I think I have another explanation for that. The forelimbs of all four-legged vertebrates exhibit a unity of anatomical pattern intelligible only on the basis of a common inheritance. Now you put that in plain English and it says, the only way it could have been this way is because they evolved from a common ancestor. And I just disagree with that. You find the same kind of quotes and you find it in all sorts of books. But let's give them their best argument. The best argument comes at the molecular level. This is a generalized representation of a living cell with all of its little components that we know about since we've been able to play around with things like electron microscopes. Now what you find out is that there are certain critical components of life at the chemical or biochemical level, okay? Structural materials like proteins, okay, that make up our muscles, for instance.